the Tulsa Race Massacre isn't just a Tulsa story or an Oklahoma story. It's a national story. It's an event of national importance that people had been denied, kept from learning about for a long time.
That's Scott Ellsworth, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. Scott Ellsworth teaches in the Department of Afro-American and African Studies at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Ellsworth is a New York Times bestselling author who's also written about American history for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times. Formerly a historian at the Smithsonian Institution, he's also the author of The World Beneath Our Feet and Death in a Promised Land, his groundbreaking account of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre. He revisits that topic in his latest book, The Groundbreaking, An American City and Its Search for Justice. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much. I'm really glad to be with you today.
You know, I'm embarrassed to say that I wasn't aware of this horrific race massacre until I saw it portrayed on The Watchmen. And even then, because The Watchmen is fiction, I had to look it up to see if this was real, because I couldn't believe that something this horrible had happened and I'd never heard of it before. And I've since learned that I wasn't the only one that was experiencing that. So why is this massacre not more widely known?
Well, it's for the simple fact that for more than 50 years, the story of the massacre was actively suppressed. Official records were stolen and destroyed. Photographs were confiscated. Tulsa's two white daily newspapers for nearly a half century went out of their way never to mention it. Also, ironically, in the African-American community as well, too, the massacre wasn't discussed in a public forum. A number of massacre survivors suffered PTSD for decades, and many of them, like Holocaust survivors, didn't want to burden their children and grandchildren with these memories of these horrific events that they had gone through. And plus the fact that people attempting to research the massacre were threatened, some with their lives, some with their livelihoods, as late as the 1970s. So, you know, for 50 years, the story was buried, and it's taken us about 50 years to get the story out.
Well, I want to talk about some of the things you just addressed in a little bit more detail in a moment. But before we get to those specifics, give us an overview of this book. What are readers going to find here?
Well, they're going to find a few different things there. First of all, they're going to find an account of the massacre itself, one that, you know, also incorporates, you know, new knowledge that we've learned in the past decades. Part of the way to explain the book is, you know, I'm a native Tulsan, born and raised in the city. I had heard stories about the massacre growing up in the 1960s, but you couldn't find out much. Then beginning in the summer of 1975, as a 21-year-old college student, I began to write my senior thesis in college about the massacre. So for the past 45 years, off and on, I've been working on this. So it's an account about how the massacre, the story was suppressed, how the story finally came to light and the people who helped make that happen. And it's also an account of the search for the mass graves that's ongoing, also the battles to win restitution. And finally, it's an account of an American city that's trying to have a reckoning with its past that's happening as the nation itself tries to do the same thing.
Well, I want to learn more about what precipitated this in just a moment, but set the stage for us. What was this prosperous African-American, you know, sort of subdivision of Tulsa like before the event took place?
Well, it was a remarkably vibrant community. There were two movie theaters. There were a dozen churches. There were two newspapers. There were over 30 restaurants. There were 30 grocery stores and meat markets. Greenwood had two schools. It had its own hospital, had its own public library branch, had a U.S. post office substation. There were tailor shops and dress shops and photography studios and dry cleaners and billiard halls and whatnot. It was home to about 10,000 people. There was a small class of merchants who did quite well, and they lived in modern one- and two-story wooden homes with automobiles and pianos and all of that. There was a larger group of 100 or more sort of African-American entrepreneurs that had smaller businesses. But it must be said that the vast majority of people lived in Greenwood worked in the white community in service level jobs as chauffeurs and butlers, maids, cooks, dishwashers, ditch diggers. But they got a good salary. There was a lot of money in Tulsa. Tulsa was an oil town, and they got a good paycheck every week. And they came home and spent that money in Greenwood, which allowed for these black businesses to prosper.
So this was 1921 when this happened, May 31st and June 1st. What set this off?
Well, I'll try to be brief. There was some sort of an incident in an elevator in a downtown office building in Tulsa on Monday, May 30th, involving a young African-American shoe shiner and a equally teenaged white elevator operator. When the young man, whose name was Dick Rowland, tried to step onto the elevator, it appears that he tripped, that he stuck his hands out to break his fall, that unfortunately one of his hands caught the shoulder of Sarah Page, the white elevator operator. She screamed. He ran out of the building. The police were summoned, but they didn't seem to be too concerned about it. They didn't arrest him until the next morning and brought him to the jail at the courthouse. And the wheels of justice seemed to be, you know, calmly turning. But that afternoon, Tulsa's afternoon white daily newspaper, the Tulsa Tribune, wrote this fantastic and racist write-up of the incident, claiming that Dick Rowland had attempted to rape Sarah Page, scratched her face, tore her clothes. They also ran a now lost editorial entitled "To Lynch Negro Tonight." And a half hour after that newspaper hit the streets, there was lynch talk on the streets of Tulsa. By 9 o'clock that night, more than 1,000 whites had gathered outside of the courthouse in whose jail Dick Rowland was held. Meanwhile, word hit the black community of the peril that this young man was in. And at around 9:30, 10 o'clock that night, 75 African-American World War I vets, all armed, drove down to the courthouse, presented themselves to the sheriff to help defend the jail if necessary. The sheriff sent them away, and as they were leaving, an elderly white man tried to disarm a black vet. A shot went off, and the single worst incident of racial violence in American history began at that point.
Well, this lasted for 2 days, and the destruction was massive. The loss of life was massive, and I understand you're still really trying to get an accurate count of how many people were killed during that.
Yeah, I mean, this was an astonishing event. I mean, where the next morning on June 1st, mobs of whites in the thousands invaded Greenwood, went block by block systematically, looting and then setting buildings and businesses and homes on fire. There were a lot of firefights as African-Americans fought to defend their community, but in the end, they were simply overwhelmed. So during the massacre, more than 1,000 black businesses and homes were looted and put to the torch. More than 35 square blocks were burned. The community looked like Hiroshima or Nagasaki afterwards. We know that there was at least one airplane dropping sticks of dynamite onto Greenwood while this is happening. The Tulsa police force did nothing to stop the mob. Instead, they arrested African-Americans and took them to internment centers. In the end, more than 10,000 people were made homeless. And to this day, we don't know how many people died. I think reasonable estimates go from somewhere in the 70s to maybe as high as 300. But we don't even know, you know, what the ratio is of black to white casualties.
Now, you were the lead scholar on the 1921 Race Riot Commission. I think that was about 20 years ago. Tell us about what you were able to find out then and subsequent work that you and others have been doing.
Well, we learned a lot, and I had a wonderful team of renowned scholars working with me, John O. Franklin, the famous African-American historian, and others. But one thing that I did 20 years ago is I launched the search for the unmarked graves of massacre victims, where there was a very robust oral tradition in the black and white community that victims had been buried in trenches and other types of graves. While their loved ones were being held under armed guard, and their loved ones never knew what happened to their father, their brother, their son, their uncle, their aunt, weren't told where they were buried. And so with a volunteer assistant, we interviewed more than 300 Tulsans, survivors, eyewitnesses, cemetery workers, city workers. We identified three different locations where we thought that massacre victims were buried in unmarked graves. And we uncovered funeral home records and other things proving that massacre victims were buried in these unmarked areas. Our first effort got caught up in the politics of reparations. We were shut down, but 2 years ago, the current mayor of Tulsa asked me and others to restart the investigation. And this past October, we uncovered a mass grave at Oaklawn Cemetery in Tulsa that we believe hold the remains of at least a dozen African-American massacre victims. And on June 1st, we will begin exhuming that gravesite.
Now, you mentioned reparations. Where does that stand?
Reparations, as you know, Dan, is a very complicated topic. There's a lot of emotions, pro and con about it. There's no question in my mind whatsoever that some form of monetary restitution is due to the three surviving massacre survivors that are still with us today, and also the descendants of survivors. There was, in the Riot Commission era 20 years ago, the Riot Commission recommended that monetary restitution be paid to the 150 or so survivors alive at that time. The state of Oklahoma missed a great opportunity to do so. Instead, they gave them gold-plated medals. There was a lawsuit launched a couple years later that made it all the way to the United States Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court wouldn't hear the case. There was a new lawsuit that was launched last summer, early fall, that's now working its way through the courts. But it'll be a steep hill to climb.
In terms of justice, I mean, you pointed out that city and state officials have long suppressed this story. After the events, was anyone held accountable for what happened?
No, not a single white person spent any prison time for any of the murders, the robbery or the arson of Greenwood. And even worse, the city government, after telling the world that white Tulsa would rebuild the black community, instead they tried to steal the land where the Greenwood Commercial District was by passing a very highly restrictive fire ordinance designed to keep black property owners from rebuilding. But black Tulsans rebuilt anyway. African-American attorneys defeated the fire ordinance in court, and eventually Greenwood was rebuilt.
Are there any efforts today in terms of trying to seek justice, in terms of accountability for those who were alive at that time?
Well, I think that the issue of justice is one that we have to face, not just in Tulsa, but, nationwide. But in the Tulsa case, they were let down by the city government, by the state government. They were let down by the federal government as well, too. And a number of black business owners and property owners, they all had insurance properties. All of the insurance companies denied payments. I think that if restitution is going to come, and I hope it does, I think it's going to have to come through the federal government. But hopefully some of these insurance companies that still exist, they have an opportunity now to make good on payments that their forebears denied.
We're approaching the centennial of that massacre. How would you define the state of the city now in terms of coming to terms with this event?
Well, it's, I think there's a mixture of things going on. I mean, let's be honest, it's there were generations of white Tulsans. I was certainly one, too, that never taught about this whatsoever. So you have a certain view of our history, but you're not told the full story. And, since the murder of George Floyd, I think the nation itself is in what I call the age of reevaluation. We're trying to figure out who our heroes are, who they aren't. Statues, rightly or wrongly, have been torn down. Buildings have been renamed. So we're undergoing this process now in this country of trying to come to a better understanding of our past. Obviously, it's important to teach the good things that we've done and the great gifts that America has made to the world. But we also have to not avoid talking about the bad parts. So Tulsa, ironically and interestingly, I mean, Oklahoma is by far one of the most conservative states in the country. But right now, the city of Tulsa, I think, is ahead of the rest of the nation in trying to come to an honest reckoning with its past and to try to figure out what that means.
So what do you hope that readers will ultimately take away from this book?
Well, I think there's a number of things. I hope that, you know, the Tulsa Race Massacre isn't just a Tulsa story or an Oklahoma story. It's a national story. It's an event of national importance that people had been denied, kept from learning about for a long time. So I think it's important to learn about that. I think it's important to learn, too, about the heroism of the people who kept the story alive. It's these elderly massacre survivors who, it's because of them that we know what had happened, and white eyewitnesses as well, too. I think that they should also take heart from the perseverance of the Greenwood community, that it's a community that stayed where it was, that it fought to defend itself, and it rebuilt itself. I'm also trying to take the temperature of the nation right now. We are undergoing massive demographic changes, other things. Obviously, we're divided politically, and we're going to have to find a way to get back on track and get ourselves together again. And one way to do that is to have an honest reckoning with our past.
The book is The Groundbreaking, An American City and Its Search for Justice by Scott Ellsworth. Scott, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thanks so much. It's an honor to be on Kansas Public Radio.
You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. You can use the KPR app to listen on your phone or tablet. You can sign up for the Conversations podcast on iTunes, and you'll also find us on Facebook. Conversations is a production of Kansas Public Radio. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.